Chapter 12 Cosmic Partings. I was of three minds, like a tree, in which there are three blackbirds. Wallace Stevens, 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. In The Origin, Darwin gives a sketch of a few growing twigs on the tree of life. It is the only illustration in the book, and it is highly schematic and abstract. A dozen lines of life, labeled A through L, rise upward through a series of horizontal lines numbered 1 through 14. These horizontal lines represent long intervals of time, Darwin says. And as he talks about the diagram, he keeps stepping farther and farther away from it, contemplating wider and wider expanses of time. The intervals between the horizontal lines in the diagram may represent each 1,000 generations, Darwin writes, but it would have been better if each had represented 10,000 generations. In the diagram, each horizontal line has hitherto been supposed to represent 1,000 generations, but each may represent 1,000,000 or 100,000,000 generations, and likewise a section of the successive strata of the Earth's crust. What Darwin does not do, either in this diagram of the divergence of taxa or anywhere else, is to step closer and contemplate the moment of divergence itself, the point where one line splits in two, where two roads diverge, the cosmic parting. He could not look at the point of origin in any particular case because he did not have one to offer. He did not try to contemplate the mechanics of divergence, even in the abstract, because he did not know enough. Today, as more investigators take up the study of evolution in action, they watch for these cosmic junctures, the point where lines diverge, the parting of ways. What has already emerged from these studies is how fast divergence can happen, how much we can actually see in real time. We are not talking about the lapse of ages. Some years ago, for instance, the evolutionists Theodosius Dobzhansky and Olga Pavlovsky published a now-famous article in The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences entitled Spontaneous Origin of an Incipient Species in the Drosophila Polystorum Complex. It has been questioned by His Holiness Pius XII, among others, whether biology has really succeeded in making a species from another species, the evolutionists began. The process of speciation is generally too gradual and slow to be observed directly. An exceptional situation is reported in the present article. The Drosophila polystorum complex is what is known as a superspecies. It is a cluster of populations that are partly but not completely isolated from one another by their build or their behavior, like Darwin's finches, but more promiscuous, interbreeding more freely. The polystorum complex consists of six populations of fruit flies that are, in the words of Dobzhansky and Pavlovsky, too distinct to be considered races of the same species, but not distinct enough to be regarded as full species. Their ranges lie across much of Central and South America, from Guatemala to the Andes. A superspecies is just the kind of messy, borderline case that fascinated Darwin. Here is a situation in which, as Dobzhansky once wrote, the process of species splitting has, on our time level, reached the critical stage of transition from race to species. D. polystorum is one species. It is also a cluster of species, in statu nascendi. It bespeaks the correctness of Darwin's opinion that each species first existed as a variety. Within the polystorum cluster, Dobzhansky and Pavlovsky explained, female fruit flies will mate freely with males of their own incipient species, but seldom with males of another. That is, an Amazonian female will mate with an Amazonian male, but not often with a Guianan nor an Orinocan, or any other of the incipient species in the complex. When flies in the polystorum cluster interbreed, which they do more often in the laboratory than in the wild, they tend to have fertile daughters and totally sterile sons. All these flies look alike. To diagnose an unknown strain, Dobzhansky and Pavlovsky had to cross it with what they called testers, a series of flies representing the whole array of incipient species in the Polystorum complex. The unknown strain would yield partly sterile progeny, or none at all, with most of the testers. It would give completely fertile hybrids with only one set of testers, those of its own kind. On March 19, 1958, a sample of Drosophila was collected at Chichimene, south of Villavicencio, in the Llanos of Colombia. Dobzhansky and Pavlovsky reported in the proceedings. From these flies, the evolutionists reared a strain called Llanos A. Llanos are the wide grassy plains that still cover much of South America, as in the days when Darwin rode over them on his long inland wanderings from the Beagle. Because the Llanos A strain yielded fertile hybrids with most Orinocan strains, Dobzhansky and Pavlovsky classified Llanos A as a member of the Orinocan incipient species. The evolutionists kept Llanos A alive in their laboratory at Rockefeller University in New York City, as well as strains from all of the other flies in the Polystorum complex. 5 years later, as part of an unrelated study, the investigators began testing all these strains again. By now, generations of fruit flies had come and gone within their separate population cages. But all of the investigators' strains yielded the same results as before. All of the strains, that is, but one. The Llanos A strain now behaved in a totally unexpected manner. Namely, it failed to give fertile hybrids with any strain other than itself, Dobzhansky and Pavlovsky reported. With Llanos A, no matter which testers they tried, Dobzhansky and Pavlovsky could not make a single fertile cross. Llanos A was no longer compatible even with Orinocan strains, the very same strains with which it had produced fully fertile hybrids only a few years before. Conclusions? Llanos A is a new race or an incipient species, having arisen in the laboratory at some time between 1958 and 1963. It has diverged from its progenitor, Orinocan. No one was watching in the interval, so no one saw it happen. Why did the strain diverge? Dobzhansky and Pavlovsky suspected that the flies had become infected with a bacterium. The infection might have rendered the flies infertile with any strain but their own. This probably is just what happened. Infections of that kind have recently been detected and confirmed by Drosophilists in several laboratories. The infection sweeps through the population cage fast, like cholera or flu, and it can carve invisible borders around a population, wall it off from all the rest of its kind, like a new and invisible coastline or an invisible cage, virtually overnight. Most of these infections can be cured with antibiotics, some not. In principle, the same thing could happen to our own kind, or make all but a small, lonely pocket of the human population sterile, as in Kurt Vonnegut's wonderful novel, Galapagos. If the divergence of Llanos A was driven by a bacterial infection, then it may have happened literally overnight. As with the origin of species, so with the origin of adaptations. A recent experiment suggests that this process need not be as gradual as Darwin imagined. It also shows how tightly the origin of species and adaptations are linked together. The origin of adaptations is, like the origin of species, one of the deepest problems in Darwinism. How do novel adaptations arise from small and gradual beginnings? The ancestral line of Darwin's finches was all of a kind. One set of finches blew into the islands, and today we have a finch that perches in trees, making and wielding toothpicks against grubs, and another finch that perches on the backs of boobies with its long, sharp beak dipped in their blood. How did blind creation make so many new kinds of tools? How do evolutionary inventions and innovations like these get started if their raw material is merely random individual variations? As one of Darwin's early critics writes, it is hard to see how such indefinite oscillations of infinitesimal beginnings can ever build up a sufficiently appreciable resemblance to a leaf, bamboo, or other object for natural selection to seize upon and perpetuate. No one has ever put this problem more forcefully than Darwin himself in The Origin. To suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection, seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree, he writes. But if we look at the whole tree of life, Darwin says, we can find innumerable gradations from extremely simple eyes consisting of hardly more than a nerveless cluster of pigment cells, which are rudimentary light sensors, to the marvels of the human eye, which are more impressive pieces of work than the human telescope. Darwin argues, essentially, that all the sophistications we see in the eagle's or the human's eye could have arisen gradually, by stages, across geological spans of time, each stage conferring somewhat clearer vision than the one before. We must suppose each new state of the instrument to be multiplied by the million, each to be preserved until a better one is produced, and then the old ones to be all destroyed. Let this process go on for millions of years, and during each year on millions of individuals of many kinds, and may we not believe that a living optical instrument might thus be formed as superior to one of glass as the works of the Creator are to those of man? Darwin was emphatic that all complex adaptations arise by the gradual agency of natural selection. He even makes the point a sort of test case. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Richard Dawkins defends Darwin's position vigorously in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, which is framed as a reply to the Reverend Paley's parable of the watch on the heath. Dawkins argues that selection on even the slightest nubbins and rude beginnings can build up instruments as complicated as watches, telescopes, or human eyes. As long as each stage in the evolution of a complex adaptation is adaptive for its own sake, it is likely to be preserved within each generation and be embellished by the next, by Darwin's process of natural selection. The process does not look ahead. The watchmaker is blind. Yet blind selection can build an eye. Suppose, Dawkins writes, a few nerve endings in a simple organism gave it a rudimentary sense of light and dark. Even rudimentary vision is better than no vision at all. The variant individual that carried that adaptation would be likely to be preserved, and so would those that inherited those first dim eyes. Vision that is 5% as good as yours or mine is very much worth having in comparison with no vision at all, writes Dawkins. So is 1% vision better than total blindness. And 6% is better than 5, 7% better than 6, and so on up the gradual, continuous series. The evolutionist Stephen Jay Gould notes that a big change in an organism can sometimes arise from a small change in its genes. So adaptations may sometimes evolve by big steps as well as small steps. Suppose a random change in the genes is sizable, but not so big that it prevents the animal from breeding with others of its kind. Suppose also, Gould writes, that this large change does not produce a perfected form all at once, but rather serves as a key adaptation to shift its possessor toward a new mode of life. If it began to make a living in a new way, it would find itself subject to a whole new constellation of selection pressures, just as if it had been picked up by a storm and dumped down on a desert island. In his recent book, Darwin on Trial, the lawyer Philip E. Johnson speaks sarcastically of all this supposing. Gould supposes what he has to suppose, and Dawkins finds it easy to believe what he wants to believe, but supposing and believing are not enough to make a scientific explanation. Johnson writes, adding, "The prevailing assumption in evolutionary science seems to be that speculative possibilities without experimental confirmation are all that is really necessary." There is now a simple experimental confirmation of this point. The experiment was published the same year as Johnson's book, 1991. It was carried out by two evolutionists at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, working in a borrowed corner of the laboratory of Dolph Schluter. There is a genus of finches with peculiar mandibles that cross over at the tips. There are about 25 species and subspecies of these birds in North America, Europe, and Asia. They are called crossbills or crossbeaks. According to legend, they twisted their beaks when they were trying to wrest the nails from Christ's cross. The red on the breast of the male is the blood of Christ. Darwin was intrigued by the beak of the crossbill. In natural selection, he notes how variable they are in length, curvature, and the degree of elongation of lower mandible. He notes further that some small curvature of this kind had been reported in many species of birds as a deformity, and that in good times some of these deformed birds survive. The peculiar mandibles of these finches are adaptive. As Lack notes in Darwin's Finches, there is a small-beaked crossbill that feeds chiefly on the soft cones of the larch, a medium-sized crossbill that feeds on the harder cones of the spruce, and a heavy-beaked parrot crossbill that feeds on the still harder cones of the pine. The twisted beak allows the bird to pry open closed cones. The connection between the beak and the food is so obvious that it was accepted by evolutionists even at the time Lack wrote, when his colleagues believed that most differences between sibling species have no adaptive significance at all. The evolutionists Craig Bankman and Anna Lindholm performed their experiment on 7 captive red crossbills. The red crossbill lives in coastal forests from Alaska to California, and its beak is specialized for the cones of western hemlock. What Bankman and Lindholm did was to uncross the beaks of these birds by trimming the crossed part of the mandibles with an ordinary nail clippers. This did not hurt the birds because they have no nerve endings in their beaks. It was as painless an operation as trimming claws or fingernails. The birds with uncrossed bills turned out to be just as good as ever at extracting seeds from dry, open pine cones. But they could no longer handle closed cones. Of course, they still tried, the way a declawed cat will still try to climb a tree. But with their straightened beaks, they could not get anywhere.